Good evening. I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Commerce to order. Thank you very much for having us out here at Cottage Grove. First, I think I need to make a couple of thank yous. First, to the Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Council. I understand that they were very functional in helping us get ready for today, getting the chairs and everything set up, so I thank you very much. There are a number of dignitaries here today, and I think what I want to do is just make sure everyone understands how this process works. What we're doing is the Senate Commerce Committee will be holding our hearing. This is a public hearing. We'll be taking testimony today or this evening that's going to be on the topics of methamphetamines as well as identity theft. The goal tonight is to hear from the community and also provide certain information to the community as to what we believe are some of the issues and problems that we have with these two areas and how they are intertwined. There are a number of people here in the audience which I'd like to take the time to introduce, but at the same time I know that you're here to give testimony. And we also have some very special dignitaries to give us testimony. Here at the top at the table we have the senators that make up the Commerce Committee. To my left, your right, would be Doug Wissett. Senator Wissett is the senator from the Cave Falls area. To my immediate left is Jenny Burdick from the Portland area. To my right is the committee administrator, Anna Braun. And then to her right is Senator Roger Beyer from Mount Lawala. And then next to them, we have the two representatives that are close to this area or are actually representing this area. Bruce Hanna, who is next to Roger, is the House representative for the Cottage Grove area, and to his right is Paul Hovey, who represents the Lorain Valley and then back up into the Notai and then into Eugene. And myself, Floyd Przanski, I'm the state senator for also Cottage Grove. What I'd like to do is also tell you that we'll be taking testimony tonight. We have our staff here. Besides Anna Braun, we have Karen Schofield, who is basically taking all the notes and making sure that we are not only live here but also being recorded, so it will be part of the record when we get back to Salem. The people who will be giving testimony tonight are giving us invited testimony. Will be sitting in front of us, and you'll be able to hear them. And what we will be doing after we have the invited panels, we'll be working off of our witness list. So if you want to be giving testimony, there are sign-in sheets that over to the other side, and feel free to do so. And I'm going to ask Ms. Braun, and she will just give us just a very brief overview over the bills that we have kind of in play tonight. We will not be limiting our testimony to one particular bill, so if you want to just come up and testify about a particular bill, you can tell us which bill that might be, or if you want to talk just generally about the topics of methamphetamines and how it impacts you, your community, we'll be glad to hear that, as well as identity theft. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Tonight we have two bills that regulate methamphetamine precursors, Senate Bill 313 and Senate Bill 912. We have six bills that are dealing with identity theft, Senate Bill 626, 627, 628, 629, 630, and 744.
And starting off with the testimony that we have invited, we have our Governor Ted Kulongowski. Governor.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Ted Kulongowski. I'm the governor of the state of Oregon. Members of the committee, citizens of Cottage Grove, thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss the important issue of methamphetamine and how this drug is affecting Oregon. Since I became governor, I have learned quite a bit about meth. I've learned about its production, distribution, about its effect on the neurological system, and how it affects our children. And sadly, I have become aware of how prevalent it is in our communities. One of the most troubling truths about this drug is that there is not a standard prototype for a meth user. We have found people from every walk of life with this drug. It isn't unique to a particular region of the state or any particular income bracket or gender. And it isn't limited to adults. More and more children are gaining access to this awful drug with devastating results. And children of meth users and producers are at great risk, even if they do not ingest the drug directly. As parents' neurological systems are impaired by meth, they are more likely to abuse or neglect their children. And meth production, often in homes where children are present, creates toxic waste, long-term contamination, and risk of fire. This is obviously not a healthy environment for any child. We must take a comprehensive approach that includes education, prevention, law enforcement, and treatment. On the prevention side, we've made some progress. In October of 2004, I directed the Pharmacy Board to move pseudoephedrine, a principal component of meth, behind the pharmacy counters. Since the board enacted that temporary rule, there has been a significant reduction in another number of meth labs. The next step is for the pharmacy board to adopt a permanent rule, which includes putting all medicines with any amount of pseudoephedrine behind the pharmacy counter. Further, they will create an electronic log so law enforcement can cross-reference pseudoephedrine sales with the purchase of other precursors such as iodine, sodium metal, and lithium metal. In this way, we can see who is buying great quantities of these components and crack down on meth production. My task force on meth came up with many recommendations as to how to give law enforcement the tools they need to combat meth. One bill in the legislature which I support is the Drug Enhancement Children's Bill, which increases the penalties for those who produce meth when there are children in the home. We are also trying to increase the penalties for those who dump meth waste, which is highly toxic and hard to clean up. The last thing our state needs is to spend money cleaning up this terrible drug. My staff is also working with the University of Oregon School of Journalism and the Oregon Partnership to develop prevention and educational materials that can be used by community groups. There is also a prevention campaign planned for this spring and summer. Ultimately, we can defeat meth, but we can only do so if we work together. I am buoyed by the number of people at this hearing. It shows that the community is concerned and caring, and it is that concern that will make all the difference. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak with you, and I'm more than willing to talk to you about this if you have any questions.
Thank you, Governor.
Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Governor, and I don't know if you have these, the answers to these questions, and maybe someone from your staff could get back to me if you don't have them with you. But I'd be curious to know two things. You said there's been a significant reduction in the number of meth labs since the temporary rule change, and I'd like to know if we could get some data on that as to what's significant and how many there were before and how many that has. And also on that, in the border areas of the state, specifically Portland and Jackson County, have there been a shift to, or do you know if there's been a shift to people going across the state line, picking up the precursors and bringing them into Oregon, or have they moved their production out of state?
Those are both very, very good questions. And on the specific number, let me get Craig Campbell, who is my policy person on this, and he'll get back to you on this. But let me suggest to you that a distinction I want to make. We are seeing a significant reduction in the number of meth labs after the pharmacy moved these pseudoephedrine drugs behind the counter. What I can't tell you
is that there has been a significant reduction in meth users. And it's a difference the small meth lab versus larger commercial enterprises coming in. So we still have a significant problem on the youth side of this. The issue of the border areas is a very interesting one because Idaho is actually considering adopting the rule that we adopted with their state board of pharmacy to put these drugs behind the counter. I'm quite sure that they will ultimately go to where we're going, and that is on the log and the ID. Washington is doing the same thing. They will eventually get in Oregon because what is happening, in answer to your question, yes, they do cross the border. And I have talked to the governor of Washington about this, and I know that she has a great concern about Oregon's position now actually getting people to go across the river. I believe, as I said, that they will adopt a rule similar to ours. But let me suggest to you that I really think the hammer on methamphetamine resides with the federal government. What the states are doing individually is important, is necessary, and it does have an effect. But until the federal government steps in and actually requires the pharmaceutical companies in the manufacture of these over-the-counter drugs to use other ingredients that have the same medicinal effect but cannot be used as one of the precursor drugs in the making of methamphetamine. This can be done. And I think that Senator Wyden, Senator Smith, I have appeared with Senator Smith. We have talked about this issue. He has bills in Congress that we talk with him and his people about. But it is going to take a strong federal presence to get this under control. For a long time, as you know, the problem with this issue was most of the representatives in Washington, D.C. thought this was a very limited West Coast problem. It has moved across the Mississippi. It is becoming a national crisis. And so I think the federal government not only has to, but it will step up to this challenge.
Thank you, Governor. Any other questions, Senator Meyer? I think Senator Burdick is next, and then Senator Winsett.
Thank you, Chair Brzezinski. Governor, you mentioned the importance of treatment as part of the package of programs that are necessary to deal with this epidemic. One of the most successful treatment programs we have in Oregon to deal with meth addiction in particular and drug addiction in general is drug courts, and Lane County is very fortunate to have one of those drug courts right here in Lane County. And for those in the audience who may not know what they're an interdisciplinary team headed by a judge that provides a combination of accountability, real sanctions for people who don't stick with their treatment program, and a lot of support from the treatment community and from the probation officers, and it's a team approach, and they've been very successful in dealing with this problem. My question to you, Governor, is what do you have planned in your budget and in your policy proposals to give drug courts the support they need to do this work in the meth area?
First of all, as you well know, because you chair the Judiciary Committee, the Chief Justice develops the budget for the courts. And they make the decision on how to spend their money. And the Chief Justice, in our conversations, is very sensitive to me to suggesting how he arranges the budget. So he has, I believe that the drug courts are in his proposal.
That's correct, Governor. I think people are going to also be watching to find out what your priorities are. Many of these drug courts have had federal funding. That money is going away. There are many ways to add to this this program. You can do it through budgetary line items for corrections, for other programs, for human services programs. These are all related to drug court, and I just, you know, the courts are part of it, but it's not the only part of drug court.
Let me You are in a process now in the legislature, and you know this better than I do right now, because I struggled with the budget for 4 months. And now you're trying to divide up limited resources that we have. And both the House and the Senate have agreed upon a number. And as I understood the agreement, it says no more, no less. And I take that at what it means. And so there is a limited pie, and on the priorities which the legislature must decide now about how to spend that money. One of the things, you know what I do a great deal of, and I think all of us have to. One of the unfortunate aspects of the budget process, you know that 95% of the budget of the state dollars are in three programs: education, human services, and public safety, which is primarily corrections. And what the state is doing is, in a time of limited resources and trying to find more money for education, for human services, for the social safety net, the one aspect of our budget that grows at a much greater rate than any other piece is the corrections. And the truth is that there's about 12,500 people in state custody. By the end of this biennium, in 2007, there will be about 14,500, and by the end of the decade, there will be over 18,000. The reality is that more and more people are showing up in the system. And what we need to understand, and which I tell people, are the choices that we're having to make. And what you're seeing in that population that's coming in are the results, a lot of drug offenses. But they're not always directly related to drugs. They're related to burglaries and robberies and other things that people do to basically secure the money to be able to buy these drugs. And I think on the prevention side of this, which frees up more dollars, is for our citizens to better understand how much of an issue this is. And I'm not sure that everybody believes that yet. But it is absorbing more and more of our state resources that I could use for drug courts, for prevention programs, for treatment. And I think that the thing that we should do, all of us, is have the citizens understand, and the people here tonight believe what I'm just telling you, or they wouldn't be here, because they believe it's that important. And it's having that much of an effect. But this drug is coming with a tremendous social cost to us in what we do with the tax dollars that we have. So my answer is better education of the public of the significance of this problem is a great treatment issue, because it gets the public focused on why they have to be supportive of the changes that we want to make. At the same time, the corrections department, I agree with you, must put more resources into prevention and treatment of the people who are in their custody. And I think that that's what Director Williams is trying to do. But it is a tough struggle on priorities that we're having right now about what to do with the money we have. So I can't promise you that everybody gets everything that they want. But I do know where to start this debate, is having us all understand what the cost of this is and the choices that we're being forced to make in your position and mine because of the cost of methamphetamine.
Senator Wessler.
Mr. Brzezinski, thank you, Mr. Governor. While drug courts are the most effective means that we currently have to address treatment of meth addiction, they're only about 30% effective, which means that they're about 70% ineffective. Mm-hmm. And I think that underscores the need that we have for research to determine what the actual causes of meth addiction within the brain, the physical chemical changes it's causing. So what are your plans for the task force to address our lack of understanding of how effective treatment of meth addiction
It's interesting. Thank you, Senator. This is the one task force that didn't go away after it published its report. It's still there, and it's still ongoing, and it is still taking issues, trying to find out what is the best use of the resources we have, whether it's drug courts or whatever it is. You stated an issue which is, I told you at the beginning, I've seen people who have become addicted to this, and one of the most challenging things for me, which is the question of why people do this, why they get hooked on meth. I have met more people who at one point in their lives were no different than anybody in this room. They were hardworking. They went to church on Sunday. They went to work. They had beautiful children, and they loved their children, and they took care of them. And I don't know the answer to the question that you're asking, that they started on meth. And it isn't a very long trip that they take to the, it absorbs their whole life. And I have seen the photos and I've heard the stories of parents who love their children who end up, when they get high on meth, they nailed plywood over the crib because they knew that, in fact, that they weren't going to be able to take care of the child, but they didn't want the child out of the crib. But they're not taking care of him. They don't feed him. They don't clean him. Hurry him or her. I don't understand this, because these are very good people. You've seen the same photos I have. I mean, I've seen people who in 1 year look like they've aged 40 years. They lose their teeth. They lose their hair. They have sores all over them. I can't understand. It's hard for us to understand why a person does it, but the question of why would someone who had everything going for them in their lives get hooked on this? And that's the part that I wish I knew more of, and I think the committee is going to be looking at a variety of these issues about how we got to this position. I just don't understand it, to tell you the truth, but I see the consequence of it, and it's just disastrous for them and us.
Dr. Peter Kohler, president of OHSU, has submitted a National Institute of Health grant proposal to enable the university to study those physical and chemical changes within the brain. And I think that's something that we really should get behind and make every effort to see that OHSU does get that grant, because I think that's critical for, you know, in my mind. Okay. My curse as a veterinarian is I have to always look for the absolute cause of something, and the cause is what is, of what you just described, in my opinion, is those physical and chemical changes that occur in the brain as a result of that addiction. And until we can determine what that is, it's going to be very difficult to figure out a way to treat it.
I agree with that.
Anything else? Representative Hovey.
Thank you, Chair Pozanski. Governor, going back just a couple steps to the discussion of the drug courts, and you know, the statistics that I've seen show those programs to be extremely cost effective. For every dollar we put into those programs, they save us $7 to $11. And given that we have this huge problem before us, and we're in this midst of spending a pretty a large amount in our budget for expanding the infrastructure of prisons and corrections, and at the same time our counties have jail capacity that they're not using because they're not getting the funding that they need, do you think there's any way that the legislature could slow down the expansion of that prison infrastructure and fund some of the more of these drug court type programs, thinking long term that would pay off for us?
Well, you know, one of the things, and this isn't it's part of the educational process,
you know, a lot of times that the citizens get mad at you and me, and they think that the government has done something, and sometimes they don't look in the mirror and realize they've shot themselves in the foot, because on this is something that was created by the initiative process and has a constitutional component, which is something that, as the governor, I have to comply with, because when I build the budget, just as you're going to build the budget, you have to address those things that are mandated. One of the things that we do is we get a prison population forecast, and I have to actually, as the governor of the state, look at where we're going and make sure that when we get there that we have adequate bed capacity in the state system. And so that's why I put the Madras facility online. That's why the Lakeview facility is gone, I should say, in the construction phase, and I put the Lakeview facility online. That's why we're going to have to create 700 more beds, and I think 400 of them are up at Coffee Creek, which is a women institution, and it's one of the reasons why this is not just a male issue, is because more and more women are showing up in the system addicted with meth. So my answer to you is that I think that we have to meet our constitutional and statutory obligations to be able to handle the prison population that's coming in. The issue of utilizing other revenues maybe use the drug court as an alternative, I think it's something the legislature has to do. This isn't the only social or treatment program we have. You can make choices, which is I had to do, about which ones you want to fund. And this may be one that you look at and say that I think this should go to the top of the list. I'm quite sure that those people who have been around drug courts know that actually the driver in them is the individual judge who has the mindset that this is the most important thing in their lives. And the ones that I've seen successful, there was a judge who actually held everybody accountable and actually called these people in and talked to them and held them accountable. And it takes a special person to do that. So I'm willing to look at other treatment programs or ideas of the priorities, but the one thing that I am set on is that, in fact, that I'm not going to do something short-term that comes back to haunt the state long-term. And it's the reason for the Madras facility is to be very frank with you, it will cost me double. It will cost you double in 07-09 if we don't move forward with this, because you do need the bed space. The issue of the counties, I have got a proposal in for increasing on the community corrections side for the sheriffs, who are part of 1145 and trying to address some of the inequities in that program. Will they get everything they want? No. But they are correct that the sheriffs have not been treated fairly. Some have, but all of them have not been treated fairly in this system. With county bed space, I can assure you I've engaged this issue with Director Williams, and the issues that we generally end up with is the security of the facility that we would house the inmates. The second issue is that the cost to the state to do that. And the third issue, to be very frank with you, is that some of the people we would like to put in some of the facilities that are secure enough and are price effective, the communities don't want. And they want basically the minimum security people. And we don't have many of those anymore, to be very frank with you.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Governor, you've brought up two points that I think it might help the public to hear how they tie together Department of Corrections and the effects of meth. We've taken testimony in our public safety subcommittee from the Ways and Means, listening to the Department of Corrections talk about the effects of meth. And it hurts me to tell you that we're going to spend a combined $96+ million in our corrections facilities for medical, the combination of medical and physical health, or physical health and mental health care in these facilities. And I, like many others, have had questions about why don't we use beds in counties and why don't we use beds here and there. And One of the issues is that care that we are obligated to provide for those prisoners. And when they come in with the kind of problems that we're talking about because of the effects of meth, drugs, and alcohol, it is very difficult to provide those services in the satellite-type facilities. And when you look at how that process goes and the amount of money that we are spending to provide that care, it's one of the issues that you don't always think, gee, how much is this costing us in the facilities, in that entire Department of Corrections? But in the next biennium, we're projecting $96 million. It's astronomical.
You know, Representative Hannah, you know, if I could, it is why, if there's one thing that I hope the legislature does this time in reviewing the issues surrounding the state hospital, what we need to do is to actually require greater cooperation between the Department of Corrections and the state mental health side. Because what is happening is we separate them, and we're using our police officers as mental health officers, and we're using our jails as mental health facilities. We cannot continue to do this, and it ends up, as Representative Hanna said, being an extremely costly process. And I would tell you, I don't think we get anything out of the way we're doing it. And so what I would like us all to ultimately end up moving toward is having a facility in which corrections and mental health people are working cooperatively with those people, what we refer to on the forensic side of this, that we can actually help with their particular problem other than putting them in the state hospital or the corrections institution. They need to be in a place where they, in fact, can get treatment and get the proper care for them. And it isn't the prisons, I can assure you that.
Any other questions for the governor? Governor Kulongowski, thank you very much for taking
time. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And you don't know this, but this is coming from Junction City. This was my first district that I represented in the legislature 30-some years ago. So I'm glad you're in Cottage Grove. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I guess the first thing I want to do is just check in on the sound. If everyone was able to hear the discussions, make sure we don't need to make any modifications. And okay. So what we're going to do is we have two panels that we've invited of different individuals for giving us another perspective besides what the governor's spoken with us about. And I'm going to go ahead and ask Craig Durbin, Sean Hoare to please come up. And I'm not sure, we may have Craig Campbell joining them as well. He's with the governor's staff. He's probably checking with the governor, but I think he's going to be up here for answering questions if the committee should have any. And I'm going to, I think, go ahead and ask Craig if you'd be so kind to start. And what they'll do is they'll just give their names. And if you're giving testimony tonight, if you'll give us their name, we need to know that so the record will reflect that. And then Craig will also identify who he is so you'll know who's speaking.
Thank you.
And as I said, the other panelist will be Craig Campbell.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Craig Durbin. I am a lieutenant with the Oregon State Police and currently serve as the commander of the Drug Enforcement Section. And I want to thank you for the chance to speak before you and the members of the Cottage Grove community here. It is because of these meetings that are happening all over the state and the amount of people that are participating in these meetings that I really believe that we do have some a bright light on the horizon with methamphetamine. Just recently, law enforcement has had its worst fears confirmed in a study that was released by the National Jewish Medical Center. The National Jewish Medical Center is one of the number one industrial hygiene hospitals in the world. In 2003, they came together with law enforcement and they conducted a study to look at what was the actual exposure going on within methamphetamine labs. Now, we as law enforcement knew that these labs were bad, but we really did not understand just how bad. And I've been in hundreds of labs myself. And after seeing this study, it really confirmed our fears. What we found was that there's just extremely high levels of contamination all through these structures, wherever there's a lab. If it's a half-ounce reaction, it does the same contamination in respect to an ounce lab. But the more that you go up, there is more contamination because of the longevity of the cook. What they found was that during the cook process, if a child is in that lab, a child is actually breathing 5 milligrams of methamphetamine per hour that they're in that lab. That there's contamination at 16,000 times higher than the Washington State remediation standard. Now, that's about the same standard as what we have here in Oregon. So, and that contamination is on toys, it's on surfaces of tabletops, on flooring, on carpet, it goes down the halls in a motel, hotel room. Now, if you times that, and in your binder there that we prepared for you, and this is a binder that supports a lot of the pseudofederal legislation that we would like to do, in that binder there's a methamphetamine clan lab survey that was done in Los Angeles where they actually surveyed meth cooks, and those meth cooks told them that they cooked on an average of 49 to 72 times per year, that they taught four other people to cook per year. So if you look at that contamination level and then times that times 49 to 72 times per year, there's just a significant amount of contamination happening all over the state of Oregon, in hotel, motels, rental properties, vehicles, all those places. The awareness level in Oregon is at an all-time high, and I believe it's because of meetings like this. This drug, as we've already heard, is affecting all facets of our community. Everybody is affected. And one of the examples that I heard from Representative Hanna, as far as within the correctional facilities, even with dental needs of these prisoners, is costing taxpayers high amount of money. We have a considerable amount of work ahead of us. Currently in Oregon, in 2002, we were number one in the nation for 12-year-olds that were admitted with meth treatment admissions. Meth just recently passed marijuana, and it is now number two drug of choice for juveniles in treatment. Now, 48% of the child welfare clients list meth as a primary drug. The majority of property and identity theft crimes in Oregon are committed by meth abusers, over 85%. In 2002, 11,600 people in treatment reported meth as their primary drug of choice, and that's up 2 years prior from 9,000. In July and August, and I believe it was September, there was a study done, I'd encourage you to read it, in Douglas County of what meth did to a rural community. In that study, they found that in the offender population, 15% of the offender population were meth cooks. We have what I believe, again, is a silver lining, because we are becoming, unfortunately, we've experienced methamphetamine over the last 20 years, so we are becoming the national leader in a lot of respects in national legislation, and you've heard already some of that. We have now from our national legislative members, we have the Comprehensive Methamphetamine Response Act, we have the Meth Precursor Control Act, and the Combat Meth Act that we've signed on to. And I'd like to just touch bases about the Combat Meth Act. In that act, it talks about that they want to implement at the federal level what they deemed the full Oklahoma rule or legislation, basically what Oklahoma did as far as with pseudofedrin and pulling it behind the counter and those type of things. In that act, though, they supply $5 million to states that have those best practices in place. And with this legislation on 313 and 912, that type of legislation would allow us to go after some of those monies. I did have the pleasure of serving on the governor's meth task force and still do, as has been mentioned. This is an ongoing process, and we continue to look at things that we need to accomplish and do. And through that task force, we came up with 40 recommendations. Now, the task force was comprised of a variety of members from all the different disciplines, and it was basically a compilation of everybody's recommendations that were deemed as experts in their given field. And out of those 40 recommendations, I believe we really have some pretty exciting things happening, especially in the areas of, like, drug-endangered children. And now that we know these children are contaminated in these labs to the extent that they are, we really have to look at what we've done in the past. It used to be in the past that a lot of times if children were found in these labs, we would find a family member to take care of them. Now we know that we're going to have to take and enter these children into Child Protective Services. We're going to have to do a medical model of gaining ear analysis, long-term follow-up, all of those type of things, which are going to become expensive. The reason for that is that in Lynn Benton County, they've actually been testing children for about the last 2 years on a ear analysis. And what they found that about 34% of those children are testing positive for methamphetamine. Now, down in California, it's 55% because they test the children a lot earlier coming out of labs. We also have the precursor legislation, which I believe is one of the hinge pins to what we need to do. In the precursor legislation, 14 grams of pseudoephedrine, which is very easy to get a hold of, 14 grams, will actually make a half ounce of methamphetamine. It costs about $48. But the cost, if you add up all the different costs between police, cleanup, child protective services, all those different costs, you're looking at approximately $19,000 for that 14 grams of methamphetamine it's going to cost the taxpayers. There was an article in the Oregonian about 80-20%, 80% of the methamphetamine consumed in Oregon coming outside of Oregon, 20% by these labs. And so did we really need to deal with these labs? The problem is that 20% is exhausting all of law enforcement's resources. That's if we're reactive, we're having to spend an enormous amount of money to be able to go and train up officers to go into these labs, to deal with these labs, and they're exhausting our resources of the task forces. We've had a 35% reduction in task forces since 1999. We have task forces now that have been dismantled. And so the few task force officers that we continue to have out there are being exhausted by going into these labs. We need to get relief for law enforcement from these labs by locking up this pseudoephedrine and being able then to be able to tackle the 80% that's coming in this state. I am very, very concerned about this 80% coming in the state, and we need to have law enforcement free to deal with this. The reason I'm concerned is the methamphetamine now that is coming out of Mexico is crystal methamphetamine. It used to be powder. We used to deal with powder methamphetamine. It was approximately, at the best, about 18% pure. What is coming over the port of entry right now, according to DEA, is 94% pure, and it's smokable. As soon as you take a hit off of it, it instantly goes to the brain, and as one of the questions, well, why, how does this affect the person? They tested rats. They put a sensor on a rat's brain, and then they gave them food, and they released dopamine at 150, at a level of 150 when they gave them food. When they had sexual activity, it was 200. When they gave them amphetamine, it was 1,050. So you've got a drug that is 94% pure, smokable, instantly goes to the brain. This is not an experimental drug any longer. If our children use it just a couple of times, they can be addicted for life, and they go into treatment. The other things that would be heard here is on Senate on the identity theft bills, and we'd have a problem with identity theft, and a lot of it, is, as I've mentioned, is related. In fact, the vast majority is related to methamphetamine. It's estimated to be $2 trillion worldwide by 2005. And Oregon is ranked seventh for identity theft through January and December of 2003. So I feel that these bills, things that are being done currently by our federal legislators and by our state legislators, I travel around the nation, and I believe that we are becoming the national leader in these areas. And I do feel like there is some light on the horizon, and that we're taking good, positive steps towards this direction. And thank you for your time.
Thank you, Lieutenant Irvin. Before we take questions, what I'd like to do is have the full panel give their presentation, and we can open it up for questions. So, Mr. Hoare.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Hoare, and I'm an assistant U.S. attorney. I work out of the Eugene office, the U.S. Attorney's office here in Oregon. One of my primary responsibilities is the coordination of the federal prosecution of computer-related crimes, and that involves primarily internet fraud, identity theft, sometimes large system intrusions. I'm also part of a national team of assistant U.S. attorneys who responds to computer crime emergencies. And so I work pretty closely with the FBI and the Secret Service in responding to emergencies involving computer networks, internet fraud, and identity theft. I also train FBI agents nationally on how to investigate and prosecute with federal prosecutors identity theft and internet fraud. I say all that just to let you know that on a daily basis, I'm reading, I'm writing, I'm researching, and I'm working on cases involving internet fraud and identity theft. And I know, not just anecdotally, but in real life, it is the fastest growing crime not only in America, but in the world. It's one of the most insidious crimes because of the ease and anonymity with which it's committed, the cowardice with which it's committed, and the tremendous economic impact it has on its victims. Historically, I've worked with DEA as well on large organizational narcotics cases. And in that process, I got very familiar with the molecular effects of methamphetamine, tremendously addictive drug, devastating on the lives of those affected, not just the user, but those with whom the user has any communication. We saw not only were spouses addicted because of the association, children addicted because of the association, but a large incidence of domestic violence because of the use of methamphetamine and the results of that. It also has tremendous impacts on family members, neighbors, members of the community, because meth addicts will do anything to get their fix. Much like other addicts, they will steal from their own mother, do anything they can in order to get their fix, whatever that might be. When I received the call to participate in this conversation tonight, I was quite frankly very pleased that our political representatives were not only concerned about these serious problems, but interested in taking some sort of proactive and combined approach to it. Both of these problems are explosive. When I look at methamphetamine, and I look at identity theft, and I look at the types of cases I handle on a daily basis, inevitably they're inextricably intertwined. Just last week, I interviewed a defendant in one of my identity theft cases. And just so you know, my style generally, when I have a fraud case, just like when I have a drug case, I do my best to interview the defendant with their defendant, with an attorney across the table from me to identify who they are, what they've done, who they've done it to, identify victims of a fraud, etc. If it's a drug case, I do the same in order to identify their sources. So we climb the ladder of culpability. Just last week, I interviewed one of my identity theft defendants. One of the reasons she was stealing identities and using identities to fraudulently cash counterfeit checks by fraudulently opening bank accounts is to support a meth habit. One of the reasons her family is affected now is because she is a meth addict. Three of her children are now in foster care, one of whom is addicted. It's a challenging problem, and because of the molecular effects of methamphetamine, it's very hard for a user to stay away. She's currently in custody, and unfortunately, I know the moment she's out, she's going to be back in what we refer to in law enforcement, back in the bag, because she's a lifetime addict. And as hard as she tries, she will always be working to resist that temptation to use methamphetamine. I'm going to talk about just a couple types of cases I've handled over the years, just to let you know, affirm what you already know, about the various ways in which identity theft manifests itself. One of the first cases I handled in this area was a case several years ago involving an individual by the name of Stephen Massey and a partner of his by the name of Kari Bahati Melton. Both were meth users, and Mr. Massey supervised a ring of identity thieves in the Lane County area. Oftentimes they would steal mail, especially your pre-approved credit card solicitations that you didn't request in your mailbox but you got nonetheless. That when it was stolen, you had no idea it was stolen because you hadn't requested it and weren't expecting it. And when the credit card came, you weren't missing it when it was stolen again. And what we found is that these people literally trolled in cars behind mail trucks. And shortly after your residential mail was delivered, it was gone out of your mailbox. We also learned that these folks were using your garbage and recycling to their purposes. In fact, Mr. Massey went to a recycling depot here locally and stole a recycling bin that he took back to his motel room that he was renting with a fraudulently obtained credit card and dumped out the recycling on his floor. An accountant, unfortunately, had done a lot of tax return preparation work for a number of professionals in our community and thought she was being environmentally conscientious by recycling that material, but hadn't shredded it before she recycled it. And so Mr. Massey found on his lap, literally, dozens of tax return forms for a number of professionals, immediately went online, obtained credit cards in their names, negotiated for platinum credit cards so he could get the maximum credit limit possible, and immediately obtained 5,000 cash advances in a lot of their names and completely destroyed a lot of credit histories that had been learned or earned. So we started from a low-tech means, but his partner also had software applications to hack into personal computers. So we combined low-tech and high-tech means to obtain identity information. And again, they went online, obtained credit card accounts in victims' names in a lot of online banks, posing as those victims, and walked away with a lot of money, about 400-some victims, and it appears as though they committed over $1 million in fraud. Another case I had was a young kid out of Bend, Oregon. I had recently been convicted of internet fraud and was on probation, and as a condition of his probation was supposed to be working. So he got a job in a department store. Unfortunately, he had access to electronic databases. Fortunately, due to an astute security guard working in that store, saw him hanging around one database just a bit too long, we were able to find that he, in fact, had been stealing data from those databases. He was also a methamphetamine user, and so he was sharing that identity information with his friends that they would then sell to others, again, to get the cash to get their quick fix. I should note, in the Massey case, it all revolved around methamphetamine. Mr. Massey and his ring of thieves were all methamphetamine users. And one of the ways Mr. Massey got his identity information is that he would pay cash or methamphetamine to those who brought him identity information. They would break into your cars, they would break into your homes, and they wouldn't steal your electronic devices, although they used to 15 years ago when I had the good fortune of working for Mr. Harkerode with the district attorney's office. But now they don't steal those material goods, they take your identity information. If they have a credit card receipt with your number, expiration date, and your name, they can take that to the bank literally immediately. It's much more convertible, it's much more concealable, and it's a devastating crime. I've also handled cases where we have insiders in large financial institutions who feed account information to somebody on the outside who recruits runners to open up accounts in account holders' name or go to accounts in those account holder names with driver's license from various branches of our Oregon Department of Motor Vehicles with their own photographs, the defendant's photographs, but with the identity information of the identity theft victim, right? They then will go and withdraw large sums of money from those dormant accounts or cash counterfeit checks into those accounts, but because they're existing accounts, sometimes they'll be able to withdraw some of the money out from those counterfeit checks rather soon thereafter. One fraud I worked on involved a seven-figure fraud, over $1 million from a national federal financial institution, and it affected a number of branches here in Oregon. So it manifests itself in a number of different ways, low-tech and high-tech. The common denominator, however, is that methamphetamine is usually a part of it because they're usually users who are stealing identity information in order to make the scheme work, or they're users that will use the proceeds of their fraud to purchase it, or sometimes they will do other things with it as well, but they feed one another. My observation is that unless we restrict the access to these pieces of identity information, specifically Social Security numbers, you're never going to otherwise limit the problem. Likewise, until you restrict access to chemicals that combine to make methamphetamine, you're not going to solve that problem either. Now, many of these synthetic, what we call analogs, will be developed. Once you take something off the street, something else will fill its void. But as long as you're cautious, somebody's overseeing the problem, and you're trying to limit access to those precursors, ultimately you can get a handle on this problem. But they're both devastating problems, and I'm so pleased that you are trying to be proactive and working to solve them. Thank you.
Thank you. Craig?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell. I'm the senior policy advisor for the governor and have been on his staff, his point person on dealing with the methamphetamine task force and other methamphetamine initiatives that we've been involved in. And I'm just going to hit on two general points tonight. The first one is the need for focusing on prevention efforts, and the other one is to talk about the difficulties associated with treatment. We've been working in conjunction with the University of Oregon School of Journalism, several high school groups which are developing public service announcements around prevention messaging for high schoolers, and then independently with other television stations around the state and the Oregon Partnership to develop messaging that hit three distinct groups of individuals on trying to send out a prevention message. The first one is for parents of younger children, and I'll come back to that in a second. The second is high school youth, and then the third is college-age youth and those who are entering the workforce at the younger age. The reason I wanted to talk about prevention first is that if I had asked anyone in this room to jump into a vat of hydrochloric acid, it doesn't matter how much money I would pay them, every one of them would say no because they know the ramifications of that action. Unfortunately, and I must thank the committee for holding a hearing in a place like this where there's a lot of members of the public here to gain and give information, but also for the media around the state who have done a great job in spreading information about methamphetamine, but there's still a tremendous amount of misinformation about methamphetamine. We're now beginning to see that there are 8 to 12-year-olds that are beginning to use methamphetamine, and it's difficult to get parents to understand that there are high school-age kids are using drugs, let alone convincing them that an 8-year-old is interested or willing to start taking methamphetamine. The problem we're seeing is that the kids are second-generation users. Their parents are cooking and producing meth. They've become addicted to meth, and they're bringing their friends into that circle. And that's how that's being introduced. Unfortunately, methamphetamine, unlike other recreational drugs, is often conveyed to the first-time user as being an answer to their problem, not just an escape from their problems. It's described as giving you more energy. It gives you more mental acuity. So if you want to run track, it'll give you more energy. If you want to study harder, you want to get better grades, meth's your answer because it makes your mind more vibrant. And it's a great way to lose weight. Which, of course, we find the hard way is true. A matter of fact, in some high schools, they started to refer to it as the Jenny Crank diet. So the problem is we have to get messages out there that make sure that young people are as aware of the disadvantages of meth as everyone in this room knows what jumping into a vat of hydrochloric acid would produce. And fortunately, people are stepping up to do just that, and we should be very effective there. I wanted to talk a little bit about the need in that for community mobilization. Where we have seen communities mobilizing around this issue and creating a public fervor and a general unacceptance in the community around meth, we've seen that's been very effective in getting kids to say no to the methamphetamine problem when it's introduced to them. I want to talk a little bit about the treatment problems associated with meth, and I'm going to use some terminology that I don't understand very well, but I'm going to use it anyway, and that is the nerves within the brain and the way they operate. Every nerve cell in the brain has two components, an axon and a dendrite, and the axon creates messengers that it sends to the dendrite that then tells the rest of the body. The axon creates dopamine. What meth does, a normal starting brain, and the gentleman to my right mentioned a little bit about the dynamic of that. Whenever you do anything that makes you feel good, that's the axon sending dopamine to tell the dendrite things are wonderful. You have a great steak, makes you feel great, sends out the equivalent of 150 points of dopamine. I don't mean to be indiscreet, but if you engage in sexual activity, that generates about 200 points. You take cocaine, that generates about 400 points. Methamphetamine creates about 1,000 points. What happens is that methamphetamine gets into the axon, which the other drugs don't do, and it creates a huge dump of all the dopamine at once. But what methamphetamine does that other drugs don't do is it destroys the nerve cell's ability to create dopamine so that afterwards the brain can never again generate what makes you feel pleasure. So after that first high, the meth user is constantly chasing that high again, and they will never be able to use it. It's very much like draining the well. You'll still get some seepage of water, but you'll never get the amount of water out of that well that you did once you drained it. So the problem you have in meth treatment is you actually have to get the meth user separated from the drug long enough so that they are mentally capable of dealing with the treatment that's being given. And because you never permanently recover, but over a very long period of time, you can start to get back normal brain activity, which means treatment has to last a very long time, which is a very expensive process. So sometimes 6 to 12 months of community-based treatment is necessary in order for a methamphetamine abuser to start that road of recovery, which is why what many of the members of the committee have talked about, the drug courts, is proven as a very effective tool of doing that. And, of course, we're dealing with a long-term problem of children and those who are involved in methamphetamine have a whole list of long-term problems, developmentally, health-wise, and mental damage that the drug creates that the system has to bear the burden of. Obviously, you're going to hear a lot more from other people about that who know a great deal more about this drug than I do, but I wanted to at least let you know that there is hope and that we are working on both the prevention and the treatment side of things, and wanted to applaud the legislature. I've had the opportunity to speak to a number of legislators, and every one of them is very aware and very dedicated to dealing with this trouble, and I want to thank you for being here today to hold this discussion and allow us to come forward and speak. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions for any of the panelists? Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
I'd like to go ahead and call up our second panel. The second panel is going to give us more of a local perspective. We actually have two parts to this panel. I'm going to ask Mayor Gary Williams, Chief of Police Mike Grover, Heather Murphy, who is with the executive director of the Family Relief Nursery, and former state representative Jim Welsh, who's working as a lobbyist with the Eugene Association of Realtors. Mayor, I'd like to ask you to go first, but I'm also going to ask you before we get started with this panel, if you could be so kind. I looked in the audience. I see that a number of the council members are here, and I'm wondering if you could just briefly just identify for all of us who is here from the City Council.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do my best to recount who I spoke with earlier. We have City Councilor Robert Hunt in the audience, City Councilor Lindsay Haskell, City Councilor Pat Patterson, and Council President Michael Fleck. And I'm not sure if there are others back there or not. And Council Member Lynn Miller. So with that, would you like me to begin my presentation?
Please. Yes. And if you'll give us your name, just for the record.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Thank you for being here, and welcome to Cottage Grove. I am Mayor Gary Williams for the City of Cottage Grove. And I'd like to preface my comments by stating that I am an active member and president-elect of the Oregon Mayors Association. And in that vein, I have had ample opportunity to confer with many mayors and elected officials throughout the state. We have many differences, and we have many commonalities. One of the commonalities is the meth epidemic, or perhaps more correctly stated, the meth pandemic. In a word, it is insidious. It lies, promises one thing, and delivers quite something different. It steals hopes and dreams, relationships, self-worth and productivity. It steals health. It kills. Kills families, friends, and loved ones. Meth robs communities of their peace and dignity. Meth overburdens city, county, and state budgets, which are already overstressed. Meth overburdens our medical services and their related staff members. Emergency responses by ambulances, and paramedic crews are impaired in many ways when responding to the medical needs of meth users and or their victims. Relief agencies are working oftentimes beyond their capacities due to this crisis. To name just a few, CASA of Lane County, and I'm hoping you're all familiar with that group, the Family Relief Nursery and other intervention services, all are on the front lines in this war of addiction. All communities in Oregon, no matter if it's Portland or Shanico, all have this problem called meth, and all need help beyond their city limits. Thank you for your work and your support on this. And in short, I'd just like to state that the bills that I have before me, I'm wholly supportive of them. And with that, I'm open for any questions.
I think what we'll do is we'll take testimony from the full panel and then open up the panel for full questions.
Thank you very much.
Chief Gover, if you'd be so kind.
We are, in fact, arresting the second generation of meth users. Fathers are teaching their sons how to cook. Different methods were
made. I hate for the technical part, but I need to ask you to identify yourself on the record so we'll be on the
table. Oh, I'm Chief Mike Grover from the Cottage Grove Police Department.
Thank you.
We have second-generation meth cooks. Fathers are teaching their sons. There's different methods now. It's much easier. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this stuff out. In the 1980s, when I got here in the early 1980s, Cottage Grove was known for its quality methamphetamine up in the hill country where they use the P2P process. Now they're using the Nazi method for with the iodine and the pills for colds, pseudoephedrine. We could do a meth search warrant every day. Wouldn't necessarily be in the city, but we could do one every day. We have that much information. And basically, it's a free-for-all. And when I say it's a free-for-all, there's no retribution for it. Nobody's being held accountable for it. We've had to open up our own jail in Cottage Grove, a municipal jail that we keep people in, and the district attorney's office can't file the cases or won't file the cases for felony possession of meth because they don't have the resources to do it. So we took it on ourselves and we said we're going to do it. And we have do it. We'll charge them with an attempt. Our judge will give them 60 or 90 days in jail. They'll sit in our jail. And our jail is not a very pleasant place. We don't have television. We don't have radio. We don't have a lot of things. It meets the criteria of the jail standards in the for the state of Oregon, and it works fine. But we've had to do that because nobody else is going to do it for us. I don't blame anybody else. They don't have budgets. Their budgets are killed. I know Doug Harkleroad, who's sitting back there, his budget is just devastated for this. The Lane County Sheriff's Office is devastated. We don't ever see any deputies down here because they don't have any deputies available. The Oregon State Police, back in 1992, when we had an office here, we partnered up with them with two investigators that would do nothing but narcotics investigations. They set the world on fire. One of them became Investigator of the Year in the Western States through Wisson for his meth work. They were busy. It was a target-rich environment. And we had the cooperation of the Oregon State Police. They were here. They're gone. Their budget is devastated. INET in Lane County shut down just recently. Their budget, they don't have any money. The forfeiture statute's gone. We use the forfeiture statute a lot of times to fund a lot of this. In fact, INET paid for its entire budget, except for the manpower, through the forfeiture statute. That was changed by the voters several years ago, and that's really caused some problems within the state. There's no jail space or bed space in the jails. How do you hold them accountable? You know, we got to hold people accountable. The crime rate has dropped in the United States, and the reason the crime rate has dropped is because people are put in jail and they're kept in jail. Measure 11 in the state of Oregon is one of the best things that ever happened. People are being held accountable for this. We used to have to go to the federal prosecutors in order to get any kind of a jail sentence because the state didn't do it, and we did. Sean Hoare, who is an assistant United States attorney, We've worked with him, Frank Papagni. You know Frank? Frank, we worked with him over at the United States Attorney. And Tom Coffin, before he became a judge, he was a United States Attorney. He happened to live in our community. And he really, really took an interest. And we put a lot of people in jail, a lot of people in federal prison because of that. That was the only sentences they were going to get. So, you know, I've seen it come to full circle. And it's not going to go away. And I don't know what we're going to be able to do. I think the two new laws that you're trying to pass will help. I saw I was around before the other precursor law was involved with phenylacetic acid and those things. They'd go to other states to buy that stuff. And just recently on 60 Minutes, I saw where Oklahoma, they've got people going to Missouri and Illinois just to buy pseudoephedrine. You know, so if we can do something on a state level, and if the federal government can do something, we'll be better off. But I also know that, you know, the Mexican meth is just, it's cheap, and then they're bringing it in tons of it. And we got to stop that, too. Our borders are like sieves. And we've got to do something to stop this, because we'll have a third generation and a fourth generation. You know, I don't think we can tolerate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief. Heather Murphy.
Senator Prezanski and committee members, my name is Heather Murphy. I'm executive director of the Family Relief Nursery here in Cottage Grove. Thank you very much for having me tonight. I'm here this evening to speak to methamphetamine usage and the effects on very young children, and I'm happy that so many people have spoken to that so far. Family Relief Nursery is a child abuse prevention program. We're one of eight nurseries in the state currently. We work with families who are at very high risk for instances of abuse and neglect. Families coming to our doors have many risk factors, and those include significant alcohol and drug issues. Relief nurseries around the state have been working on this issue of methamphetamine in very young children for quite a few years, and we're gaining some headway, but there's a lot that we still don't know. Tonight, I would like to speak briefly about those effects, and I'm hearing many, many statistics, but I'd like to tell you three short stories that happened here, all affecting very young children and their parents. The first story took place about 3 years ago and involves a family with a young baby that came to one of our parent meetings at the nursery. Staff members identified that the father was mildly high on something but functioning and appropriate at the time. The next day, staff members discussed their concerns for the baby and possible ways to deal with it. 2 days later, on the front page of our local paper, it was reported that the father had been arrested for manufacturing meth in the home where the family was living. The baby was immediately removed from the home and placed in foster care. We have no idea how long that baby had been living with those poisonous substances around him. We did not see him for quite some time, and frankly, we were probably the most consistent thing in his life at that point. We have seen the little boy on and off for the last 3 years. He now has a younger sister in our program. There are major behavioral and developmental concerns for both of these children, and how many of those are direct drug effects and indirect drug effects will always be a question for the remainder of their lives. We've heard a little bit about the, quote, science of manufacturing methamphetamines, and as unsophisticated as that may be, it is in fact more sophisticated than our knowledge of how to deal with the after effects once children have been exposed. It should be pointed out that drug effects never go away for these children. It actually affects the way that their children's brains are wired, and I'm happy we've heard about some of that. No two children are affected in the same way, so there's absolutely no equation we have on our end to work with that. We can speak to coping skills, and that's what we've been concentrating on. Again, the ripple effects are endless. The next story is very brief but very disturbing. A family that we were involved with for quite some time had unemployment issues, many, many, many issues. One night, Dad decided to test out methamphetamine. He was already on some prescription drugs, I believe, for mental health issues. They did not mix well. He went in the house. Mom received a severe beating in front of their three-year-old daughter. Luckily, a roommate in the home witnessed that as well. The father was arrested, but Mom bailed him out the next day, back in the home, back with the children. Same kinds of things going on. The final story that I will quickly share is actually one of hope and one that has made our nursery take the next step in dealing with drug and alcohol effects in the family. It's a very young family that we had about a year ago. A young father admitted to the interventionist at our nursery that he had almost a lifelong history with meth. His parents, his step-parents, their friends, everyone around him had been involved with meth production and usage. He had tried several times to quit, and every time was taunted, even with them holding a baggie of meth under his nose and saying, "What are you, too good for us now?" That type of thing. So he kept getting back into it. He set some goals with our interventionist about what it would take to help him quit. It was very difficult, very long process. The immediate step was for the interventionist to work with him on finding some kind of treatment locally. He did not have access to transportation. He didn't have a lot of money. And all that they could find, unfortunately, locally, and I'm not putting this down, but was an NA meeting, Narcotics Anonymous. He needed substantially more than that. However, he did attend. He did receive his sobriety coin, was very, very pleased with that, and kept that up for quite some time. After many hills, what we call hills and valleys, that young family today is, in fact, a real success story. They frankly moved out of this town to get away from the environment. They live on the coast near family that is not involved with meth use. They have a young son who is highly special needs, probably drug effects, and another daughter. They are enrolled in special needs early childhood programs, and they continually call us and report, and they're doing very, very well. But that is the exception to the rule. This story and the lack of resources available to him locally had caused our staff to sit down and take a serious look at what we could do. It was a gap. Our people are highly trained in early childhood, but not trained in the depths of drug usage issues, recovery, that type of thing. So we looked at some options, and right up the road, the Relief Nursery of Eugene showed us a very highly successful program called Accessing Success, which is a peer support recovery program where people who have actually gone through recovery support parents that have these issues in the home, whether it be themselves with the issues or someone else in the home. We've heard a couple of statistics about drug court, 30%. This program actually has a 94% success rate after 1 year. Parents are reported as clean and sober. They've kept jobs, and they've retained custody of their children, which is pretty amazing. When the opportunity came up to replicate that or to be involved in a proposal to replicate that program, we jumped on it along with the Salem Relief Nursery and the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, which was also mentioned earlier. I could give you some more statistics, but we just last week hired our Accessing Success peer mentor. We're very excited about that. She's going through intensive training right now, and soon we feel that we're going to be able to refine our statistics to not only reflect very high numbers of alcohol and drug usage, but refine those to actual meth usage and other drugs of choice, and then really get at the issues and how to help parents cope through the valleys of the hills and valleys that we know happen for them. Relief nurseries, as I mentioned, have been involved in a while. We are providing wraparound services. We're working more and more every day. And I would like to suggest to the committee that as you consider tail-end solutions to this, such as prisons and other correctional facility treatment programs, etc., you also look at programs such as relief nurseries and other intervention. We aren't seen as hand-in-hand with prevention efforts around drug problems, but we are there. We are working with those children. We do know that these patterns are cyclical and generational, and we are addressing them in a way that seems to be pretty successful. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jim?
Chair Prozanski and committee members, I am Jim Welsh. I am the Eugene Association of Realtors Governmental Affairs Director and Political Advocate. Thank you for inviting me here to talk about the meth issue and ID theft. ID theft, I'm going to leave to the Oregon Association of Realtors and all the details within Senate Bill 626 through 630. They will address those. I will address more probably on the anecdotal side of things. Some of the things that I've talked to our realtors here in this area in Eugene and some realtors and property managers for properties outside of the Eugene area in the rural areas. And my wife and I both live in the rural portion of this county over in the western side and outside of Elmira. And it has personally affected our life also, and I'll tell that story also. But the effects of drug abuse and specifically meth, I think you heard already some of the statistics and what it is causing for a lot of us as property owners, as personal property owners, not only our private residents, but also the property that we have on that private residence or within that private residence. It is the burglaries that we are seeing in the rural areas. These are devastating. These are causing problems for those who want to move in those areas, but those who are living there. They're having to buy a lot of preventative measures to ward against these burglaries. We see that some of these properties that have been used as meth locations, meth cooking sites, we have found out from property managers that those sites become stigmatized properties. In the real estate industry, that's what they are called. And there's a real problem with those properties, as you also heard tonight, that those properties have to be remediated. We have state statutes that require this and county requirements. Working with our local officials, if there's a property that has been identified as having meth cooked on that property is essentially removed from ownership, or it is separated from the private property owner, the landlord, if it was a rental property. Most often that's a situation. The landlord loses the right to that property until it is thoroughly cleaned up and inspected again. But you have to understand in real estate that that property then, because of disclosure requirements in this state, and that's good for the consumer. You do want to know the history on that property, as you want to know the history of anybody that's renting your property. Their background and needs to be known, but that particular property is stigmatized because of disclosure. And if someone wants to rent it or buy the property in the future and they find out that it was used for meth cooking, it is a property that is probably not going to be rented again to someone or even sold. We find many of these property owners have had to totally tear down the property and rebuild. That's very, very expensive. You know how much it costs to build a home today. So these property owners, property managers, have done some things in the past 10 years to ward against this. Many of them are not taking on management of properties in rural areas because that's where a lot of these abusers would like to, and cookers would like to locate themselves. They want to be in the back area where nobody drives by, where they're not seen. They've become very sophisticated, even in moving around, as I've heard, in vans and recreational vehicles and other things, and cooking their meth. So we haven't seen a tremendous increase of property damage on the rental side of things, as I talk to a lot of property managers. They're warding against that, and we think probably because the meth abusers and cookers are just getting more sophisticated and staying on the move. But what we see as a direct impact is the burglaries to support, you know, an abuser and a user's habit. My wife and I noticed that we had been burglarized in mid-September of 2004. I was starting to put some things together for a camping trip. I went down and went to my storage area and shop and was putting those things or looking for those things and discovered they weren't there. So I kept moving around looking for other things and kept noticing a whole bunch of things. A lot of my tools were missing. And by the time 2 days had passed and I'd done a full inventory, nearly $7,000 of tools and equipment had been removed from storage in our shop just 150 feet from our home. We live down a full half mile, dead end, and we are the dead end at location on that lane. They had removed that because we hadn't been gone, and been gone during the weekend or any other time during the week while we were sleeping. They had burglarized our property. We talked to the sheriff's department. We talked to other neighbors, and a lot of the other ones down there had been hit the same way. We find that even in this state, some other statistics support that 90% of burglaries, even those armed robbery situations, is sounding like they're supporting meth habits. So you see the direct impact, social and economic, that's occurring here in this state. And I just want to finish this with the thank you to this committee, Chair Przanski and those on the committee, and a thank you certainly to the governor and the task force for bringing these issues to light in this state, and this must continue. We're in here to bring a final solution to this, you know, tens of years into the future, it looks like. It's going to take a long time to get our arms wrapped around this, but it's public awareness and education that will do that. And I think our legislators can lead, and that's great leadership. I appreciate that tremendously. So do the realtors, so do those others that I represent as a lobbyist. I know the Oregon State Grange is very concerned about this as rural citizens in this state. This is a big issue to them, bringing some solutions to this. So we need to get to our children and make sure, as parents and grandparents, that they understand the effects. I heard on the way to Salem today, and this was about another habit, smoking, that our effective public information sites that we have provided on a radio, and more specifically those on TV as advertising against smoking, have been extremely effective, reducing, you know, that habit of smoking tremendously. Because you show, if you show the effects, if you can show the damaged lung, if you can show the ruined life, because the effects of meth abuse or any drug abuse, you show that and you don't bar any of those effects, you show that, I think our kids will come to understand. Thank you again. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and open up for questions if there's any questions for this panel. Thank you again for coming and sharing. So the last of our invited panelists, and we're going to start in with some of our local special panelists, and that I'm going to go ahead and ask Doug Harker, District Attorney for Lane County, Ron Roberts from the Eugene Police Department, if you'll please come up and take the two seats on this side. At this time, I'd also like to ask two of the members from the Youth Advisory Council if they'd come forward, Samantha, I believe it's Dickey, and Kristen Bohr. So, Ron, if you'd be so kind to move that way, we'll have the two counselors next to you. And while they're getting situated, I did notice I wanted to say thank you to Faye Stewart, Lane County Commissioner, who's here tonight as well. Thank you for being here. Doug, if you'd like to go ahead and get started.
Sure. Senator Przanski, members of the committee, and members of the public who came tonight. My name's Doug Harkelrode. I'm Lane County District Attorney. With a short break for 6 months, I've been that since 1985, and prior to that, I was in the District Attorney's office for 11 years as a full-time trial lawyer. So that's about 30-plus years doing basically prosecution work. I would also like to tell you that my wife, Jean Harkelrode, has taught nursing for about 30 years at the local community college. She's board certified in psychiatric nursing and has spent a lot of time at the psychiatric hospital attached to the Lane County Jail until it was closed due to lack of funding. She now works part-time at the psychiatric hospital at the Johnson Unit, which is Sacred Heart Hospital in Eugene. I mention that because our dinner table conversation is about the drug addicts that she treats for $900 a day or more in the psychiatric hospital and the problems and the violence that they're associated with. She has actually been physically attacked by a meth addict in a psychiatric setting. In short, I think I know something about this problem. And I would tell you that you heard some great testimony from a variety of people about the problem. You heard a little bit about what might be the solution. I don't believe you can solve this problem, actually. I know that in the mid-80s, Lane County was number three in the country for methamphetamine production by one study back then. This is not a new problem. It's been around for as long as I've been prosecuting criminal cases. What I do think is you can make a dent in this problem. This is about resources and spending them smartly, if you will. Now, we do have a drug court, and it's been mentioned here. Judge Larson came to me about 10 years ago and said, Doug, we need to do this after going to a national conference. He and I have been friends for 30 years. I said, you say we need to do it, Darrell, we're going to do it. Drug courts do not work, and they are without a prosecutor who's willing to take risks. Because every time you put somebody in drug court, there is the risk that they will do something bad, really bad. And maybe you could have stopped that by prosecuting them more aggressively. However, a bunch of DAs are willing to take those risks, and we do have drug courts. I thought it was really perceptive to hear that it works about 30% of the time. What I know is we screen 40 or 50 drug cases a week in Lane County, and some we screen into drug court and some we screen out. What I know is we lose a whole bunch of those people before they ever really even get started in treatment because they're addicts. Whether it's methamphetamine, cocaine, or heroin, they never make it into the treatment component because we can't house them. You got to hold these people. So, all right. So here's the way I think you make a dent. And this is about money. First, you got a suppression component. You have got to suppress the manufacture, the distribution, and the sales. You have to suppress that. You can suppress it by making it harder to get the chemicals. That's a great idea. When we do that and we take out all the pseudoephedrine and so forth, they will figure out another way to manufacture meth or some other drug. But it'll work for a while. So you have to suppress. How do you suppress? You suppress with law enforcement. What that is narcotics teams. That is interdiction teams. That's probably politically incorrect because we end up profiling and stopping people of minority descent. However, we've had a lot of those cases in the past that have held up because they don't stop people for no good reason. But this stuff is coming across the border from California into Oregon. So you got to do suppression. Suppression is police officer. We've lost 200-300 Oregon State police officers, maybe more in the last 15 or 20 years. You all know that. So we have 200 or 300 police officers less to do suppression on a statewide basis. So you can focus the resource and say, don't work, but then you have to pick the crime you don't want them to work as they focus on methamphetamine. Those are hard, hard choices for police officers. All right, so suppression. You got to have then, that just starts the chain, because then you got to have the prosecutors, and I know you're all very familiar with all of the different steps. There must be 15 different players in the criminal justice system, all that have to be balanced in the funding process to make it work. I can tell you right now, I told you we're screening 40 or 50 of these cases. You know what I'm doing with small quantity methamphetamine cases in Lane County? Those are felonies under Oregon law. We're filing them as traffic tickets, as violations where they only get a fine and we're not dealing with them. Why? Because we have 22 criminal lawyers for 8,000 criminal cases. I can't get there from here. So we make choices. Now, I could choose to do all those drug cases, but which domestic violence case am I not going to do then? Because we have hundreds of those, too. So you're going to have to fund the prosecution component. Then if you're going to supervise these people, you need your parole and probation officers adequately doing it. How can a probation officer supervise 110 sex offenders a month? The answer is they can't. So what do? They case bank, which is just keep them in the computer, the methamphetamine users, because they're already way overburdened with the sex cases. So this is a resource issue, and it goes right on down the line. Okay, so you got to suppress. You can do some of that smartly, and you will make a dent. You will make a dent. All right. When you don't, so now you've done the suppression, now you've got to do the treatment. You heard a whole bunch of testimony about the treatment. Treatment for methamphetamine users is very, very difficult, and it's very, very expensive. 6 months, our experience with Lane County drug courts is 6 months ain't enough unless they're really not very addicted. We can fix the ones that are not really very addicted, and it's certainly easier with some of the other drugs. But if they're really addicted, you need residential treatment. And the price just went up when you say they have to live somewhere and we have to house them. The idea that we're going to treat them 1 or 2 days a week on a show up for counseling, that isn't going to cut it. So you have to have effective treatment. Effective treatment is expensive. Lane County, our drug court, that's the one component where we have struggled for years, was trying to find the money to treat these people. And if you don't have effective treatment, you might as well not have a drug court. Waste of time. You might as well just run them through the regular justice system. You've got to have effective treatment, and it's going to cost some money. That's all there is to it. Now, you've got them in treatment, and they have a dirty UA, i.e. they're using again. You should expect relapse, and you should expect it a bunch. Now your judge, what does that judge need? That judge needs some kind of a sanction. Short jail time is an effective sanction if you don't put them in too long. Well, in Lane County, and I suspect other places, I know we have 119 beds that are closed because we don't have the funding to fund those jail beds. Our drug court judge begs for space in the Lane County jail because he needs a sanction. So you've got to have those sanctions when they fail. And they will fail over and over again. But you know what? If you keep one addicted mom who's pregnant off meth and she has a drug-free baby, you just saved hundreds of thousands of dollars. And boy, was that ever worth it. And we've done that a number of times in Lane County. And I give our judges great credit for managing those people and doing it. This is hard work, by the way, for these judges. I mean, this is not their traditional role, and they just got to love, they got to really want to do it. Okay. So now, by the way, when they fail, they will steal again and again and again. And you got to sanction those. By the way, our sentencing guidelines, not yours. You weren't probably, most of you, there when it was passed in 1989. I was there. Yeah. Those sentencing guidelines, you could have a small quantity of meth 6, 7, 8 times and have those as convictions and never make it to the penitentiary and fail one treatment program right after another. And we have those kinds of people. I'm not suggesting you need to put them in the penitentiary. That's awfully expensive for that. But those people are a real problem. All right, the prevention side of this. Senator Prozanski knows that I spend and have spent most of my non-working time working with kids and trying to make a difference there in a whole variety of ways. And the prevention component is absolutely critical in this. I know that doesn't sound like I'm a prosecutor, but it is absolutely critical. I may be the most liberal prosecutor in the state of Oregon, although I don't know that I want that label. But the prevention component is really critical. And what I think prevention is all about is providing wonderful opportunities for kids where they have a great time doing something that's really healthy and exciting to do. But there's other people who know more about prevention than I. So that will make a dent. It won't solve the problem. And by the way, this is just the drug du jour. Not that it's not unimportant. It's not. But it's just the drug du jour. Over time, we've had other drugs, you know, cocaine, and when it became crystallized in form, that was a big problem, particularly in Portland a number of years ago. This one will come and it will go, and right now it's back big time, and we do need to deal with it. So, all right. I actually showed up tonight not to talk about this, but to talk about a couple of these other bills, but I think I'll save that for later. If you even get to the bill, Senator, I'll stop. Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Chair Przanski and committee members. My name is Ron Roberts. I'm a police lieutenant with the Eugene Police Department. The Eugene Police Department strongly supports the passage of Senate Bills 313, 912, and 630. I have prepared written testimony, which I have submitted for your review, so my comments will be brief tonight.
Yes. Thank you.
Senate Bills 313 and 912 specifically address a significant methamphetamine problem facing the state of Oregon. We believe it is very important to restrict and monitor ephedrine-related products sold over the counter. Individuals who knowingly steal, purchase, sell, or distribute equipment and products used for methamphetamine production should be held accountable. These two bills contain provisions we believe will have a positive impact on the methamphetamine problem. Senate Bill 630 contains provisions that will reduce the amount of personal information that is often thrown away, making unknown persons vulnerable to identity theft. We would also recommend that this bill or others contain a provision that should an entity become aware of personal information being released inappropriately, reasonable effort be made to notify the party of this concern. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. I would be happy to answer any questions when you're ready.
Lieutenant, thank you. Ladies, how about, let's see, we have Samantha and Kristen, so whoever would like to go first. And you, I think you can leave the mic there. They're pretty sensitive from what I'm hearing that we may be getting a little feedback.
Okay. For the record, my name is Samantha Dickey. I'm part of the Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Council. I don't have a lot to say, but hopefully it's something that you can take away from you or with you. So being a senior in our high school, I don't see a lot of adult meth use, but I do, however, see how it's affecting today's youth. I have been to high school parties, and I've seen firsthand what effects meth has on our students here. A good friend of mine, Gloria DeCerny, was a very athletic, smart, school-spirited, involved teen. And I was her friend when she started using, and I saw over time how it affected her. And along with her outward appearances and missing classes, I saw her attitude also start to get lower. She started replacing some of our movies and girl hangouts for parties and drugs. Eventually, Gloria died as a result. And these people out there on meth aren't just random people. They're our loved ones. Let me cry. There's a lot of families out there who are missing relatives due to meth. Linda DeCerny, Gloria's mom, is here tonight. And along with other families and their lost ones, she'll have to wake up every morning for the rest of her life, knowing that Gloria won't be there anymore. So even though we can't eliminate all methamphetamine use right now, hopefully if some of these bills pass, it'll be harder to obtain some important ingredients. And I think that even if it stops one addiction or saves one life, that it should happen because, in my opinion, even that one life would be worth it. So thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hello. For the record, my name is Kristen Borg, and I'm a member of the Cottage Grove Youth Advisory Council. I'm here tonight to talk about the methamphetamine problem, and I would like to tell you a little story. I'm 15 years old, and I'm a sophomore at Cottage Grove High School, the same age as my brother was when he got addicted to meth. Dustin was a bright, sweet, caring boy who loved basketball, had a beautiful homecoming queen girlfriend, and was even a math tutor, not to mention my Superman. He was very outgoing. He loved sports, he loved life, and he loved everything to do with it. As a junior, he had a son named Jaden, and he was very involved. He loved everything about life, and he was always protective and always sweet and always there for me. Slowly, it began to turn. And it began to change, and he became colder and more distant, and pretty soon it wasn't my brother anymore. I'm not sure that I know him today. He began to steal, and he began to use more drugs and to experiment, to be gone more and to never be around. And I think that we definitely need to do something about this today. We need to make a dent, if not change it. and we need to make it harder for people to get these things today. He now has a daughter, and he's been in and out of jail quite a lot, and she's living in not a very good environment right now. She's 7 months old. Her name's Jenna, and I'd really like to fix this. It's hit very close to home, and I would love to see my brother again. But not the meth, not the person that I know now, but I want my brother back home with me. And if there's anything that anyone can do for a chance at this, or even for one more little sister Superman to stay home with her, I would like to do everything I could for that, and I would like these bills to pass.
Thank you.
Any questions for the panelists?
Ladies, I would like to ask you, Kristen and Samantha, you're here, students here at College Grove High School. What is it that you could tell us that we might be able to do in the sense that you would help make that dent that you want us to do as to getting the message to your peers and maybe your brothers and sisters that may be younger than you? What can you suggest for us to how we might use our resources to make that dent?
Well, I think that it's pretty easy these days to find the ingredients to make meth, and I think that our high school, even though they sometimes don't appear it, are very smart, and they are finding these things out, and I know from personal experience that it's very, very easy in our high school to find someone that will even just give you things like methamphetamines. So I think just making it harder to buy, I know the Sudafed and those kinds of things, if there was just a way to make it harder to get these ingredients that, you know, some people might be a little less motivated than others and might think, you know, if I have to go through all this, it might not be worth it. So it might just be easier just to quit or not sell anymore. And I think just if it was harder to get a hold of, I think that that would definitely reduce the risk, especially in a small town like this.
Kristen?
Well, as Sam said, it is not hard at all to get any kind of drug that you would like to experiment in school. And we are teenagers, and teenagers do experiment. It's part of growing, and it's part of learning. And some good, some bad, and not everyone experiments with drugs specifically, but I know a lot of people do, especially in a small town where it has outskirts and roads and places where it's easy to... You know, it's easy to
experiment.
And I think that if there was just a lot of people get lost in the crowd and get lost to things to do, and it's a very easy connector to different people. It connects people together, but not everyone likes it, and not everyone does it. And I think that if there's more activities, more things to do, and if more people knew that this isn't the only way that you can get recognized and that people will pay attention to you and people will know you, that they'd be less likely to do it. If it was harder to get and there was more activities, I think it'd be a big help.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Hobie.
Thanks, Samantha. And I just wanted to ask a question of, do you think the schools or the information and education is present enough in your schools to really tell kids how dangerous this drug is and how devastating they are? Is that message out there?
Okay, definitely. We're excited about this.
We got this one.
We do. Our health teachers, Ms. Hansen and Mr. Kalander, are here today. They are wonderful teachers. I think I've learned more this year about drugs and what they can do to you and what happens and everything than I've ever heard of in my life. It's a really great program, and I think it's way in depth and it's way informative, and I think that it's helping a lot of people, and I talk about it and there's notes and it's really elaborate with visuals, and I think it's a really good health class, Mr. Kalander. So, thanks.
And I unfortunately did not have them as health teachers when I was here. There was another teacher. And even though we did cover drugs and what it can do to you, I don't think we did it as thoroughly as they're doing now. And I think even still, even though it's being covered, I think that there's always going to be more that we can do to help. And I think that in our school, they are taking big steps to crack down on the drugs, but I still think that there's a lot more that they could be doing. And I'm sure if they ask that, you know, our students are so willing just to tell the truth about what's going on, and they'd be willing to help. And I think that there's a lot more that we could be doing that we aren't seeing done, even though some things are getting done. I still don't think it's enough.
Any other questions? Panelists, thank you very much for sharing with us tonight.
Thanks.
What we're going to do now is start taking some additional testimony from other individuals that are not representing different groups. We have a rule with the in the legislature that if someone travels more than 100 miles, we give them preference. And at this point, I'm going to ask Jesse Backman, I believe, to please come forward. And Mr. Backman, if you'll sit in the first chair, I'm going to go ahead and call up some other individuals that they would also come up, and we can kind of work through a panel at the same way. Amanda Kramer. Kramer, I guess, and is it Diana Kramer, if they were going to be testifying? And if not, then I'd like to ask Eric, is it Colander? Mr. Backman, why don't you go ahead and get started, and then we'll carry on.
My name is Jesse Backman, and I actually live in Tillamook. And I didn't know that this was going to be both an ID theft and a meth when I came down here, because I'm looking at mostly as ID theft. But I'm a forced inmate crew coordinator for the Department of Forestry. I run an inmate crew out of South Fork, so I actually get to work with meth people after they get incarcerated. Somewhere up to like 27 months and stuff, so I'd like to comment on that after I'm through with this part, if I could. First, I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for allowing the opportunity to speak. And I wrote down here that I come here today as a father and a grandfather of an ID theft victim. My son, whose name is Jesse Backman also, about 7 years ago went up to Washington looking for work as a construction worker. He just got through working with the Job Corps. And while he was up there, he got his wallet stolen. And the person that stole his wallet used his ID, went out and committed crimes. And my son did not know about it. We didn't know about it until about 4 years ago when he went to work one day and the county sheriff came over with a warrant for his arrest. And then to Barrett Temporary Service where he was working, and his own persuasion, he convinced the sheriff that it wasn't him. He had proof of ID of where he'd been during the time frame this was supposed to be. And now that warrant still sits there. They're looking for the guy who used him as an alias. And I'm looking at this Bill 744 as a way to give him some sort of relief so he can prove to the world that he's not the guy that did the crime. And as far as working with on the other aspect there was people with criminals with the meth, my lead man just got out. We run 10-man crews. We do forest fires, plant trees, and stuff is what we do with these inmates. And he'd been with me about 27 months. This is his fourth time down as a meth cook. We have talked tonight a lot of good information on how to help keep the tools and the trade out of these people's hands. That's very important. But also, what are we going to do when he gets out? He's being released back into the same society that he got in trouble four times in a row. He knows that on any given night, he'd go out in the hills and cook up $30,000 worth of money. I stepped outside and talked with the governor's aide there and told him one of the things that I asked my crew, and I've been up there for 14 years, why do they get involved in this crime? And it's the money. It's an easy way to make money. So before you really look at trying to address the problem, really removing everything what everybody said is good, but you also got to look at some way that you can keep these people from having to look at it when times get tough, which they will for them, that they can make $30,000 in one night. How can we go about doing that? That's kind of the question I think society has to look at. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So
Senator Prusansky and the committee, thank you for giving me the chance to speak. My name is Eric Cullender. I'm a teacher, health teacher here at Cottage Grove High School, and I'd like to say two small comments. Number one, you're clearly aware now that once the horse is out of the barn, so to speak, it's very difficult to get that horse back in. I have to disagree with the state police gentleman that spoke earlier in terms of meth addicts and meth being the drug of choice of many convicts. It's not the drug of choice. When you become addicted to meth, you don't have choice anymore. This is compulsive use of medication. This is compulsive use of means that, to fit your habit, to feed your habit. You're a slave. So I would urge you, as you think about bills, and I'm in support of every single one of these bills, to also remember that if we can prevent the cycle from starting, we no longer have the addicts who are incredibly difficult to treat, whose cravings go on for years and years and years and years for reasons that we don't know. And what I'd like to see is lots of recognition. Let's get the message to the young people before this even starts. Let's make sure that the education is getting to them. Let's make sure all the teachers who are supposed to be teaching about them know about this problem and how to teach it. This is relatively new stuff, and a lot of teachers don't know how to teach this stuff. They don't really know the extent of the problem. They don't know what's going on. And to be quite honest, neither do the experts. We don't know what causes these cravings. We don't know why the cravings persist for so long. We don't know why this is such a highly addictive drug. All we know is it's incredibly addictive, and once they get started, there's not much coming back. It's destroying our community, and it's destroying all the communities in our state, and you know that better than I. It's destroying communities all over. So I'd like to urge you, please, remember the kids is where to attack the problem. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Senator Westlake and Senator Burdick.
Senator Brzezinski, just a quick question. At what age do you think it would be most appropriate to start teaching about methamphetamine and other drug addiction within a school system?
Middle school. Middle school, for those who didn't help or hear me, you've heard our two student representatives talk about that's pretty easy to get in high school, but if you really want to address a problem, you have to start 2 to 3 years before that stuff becomes available to them. So middle school, it's not too early to start that, in my opinion. And I would continue emphasizing that not only meth, but all the other drugs that are out there, and the people who say that you get rid of meth and they'll invent another one, that's true. We really have to keep our fingers on the pulse. We have to know what's out there. We have to know what's being developed. We have to be just as nimble as the people out there who, for some reason or another, choose it to sell it to our children. And we have to be able to address this problem with our children and honestly talk to them about it and not stand up there like so frequently we do as teachers, don't use this, it's bad. Let them know why it's bad, what's going on, what to look out for, how to protect themselves. Give them the tools so they can protect themselves 2 to 3 years before they're at risk. Now we've heard about 8-year-old meth users, the children of the cooks, so forth and so on. That one's harder. Where do you start there? I don't know. But at least middle school would be my recommendation. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. This question kind of goes to how you different. I mean, clearly meth has some unique properties that make it extremely highly addictive, extremely difficult to treat, et cetera, et cetera. So we're telling our kids from an early age, okay, put your seatbelt on, wear your helmet, don't do marijuana, don't do drink, you know, don't drink, don't dive off of cliffs head first, don't do this, don't do that, don't do the other thing. And our two young articulate witnesses pointed out very correctly, and I am the mother of a teenager, that the teenage years are the time to try things. To try meth can be a devastating, lifelong, fatal, in some cases, decision. How do you differentiate when you're teaching kids about all these things that they shouldn't do and should do? How do you differentiate meth?
It's just as easy to do that as it is to sit in your chairs and decide how to divide up diminishing amounts of dollars to all the problems in Oregon. I can tell you what I try to do. I've got great kids at this high school. They're incredibly open, as you heard those two young ladies, and they are exceptional young ladies, but I have a lot of exceptional young men and young ladies who tell me all the time, I have had kids, when I was talking about meth, offered to bring some in so we could show the class. And I almost said, that's a good idea. No, that's not a good idea. It's normal for adolescents to explore. Adolescents have to explore in order to be able to take on the roles of adulthood. I don't think it's wise to say don't explore. It has to happen. What I try to do is to introduce to them that as they turn into adults, they are also becoming the decision makers for their lives. And I think it's our job to let them know as honestly as we can what is out there, what to watch for, and to know and to trust them to make the right decisions. I don't think we can do anything more than that.
Jay, and I appreciate the work you're doing that was just testified to. Thank you.
We love our kids. We've got great kids.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I'd like to call Cheryl, I believe it's Janinti. I know I just butchered that name.
McGinnity.
And Carla George. I apologize for the butchering of the names.
Pardon me?
I apologize for butchering names.
I told him you didn't care.
No problem. I'm very used to it. Senator, my name is Cheryl McGinnity.
McGinnity, thank you.
Yes. And I'd like to thank you all for having this time to listen to us and for providing this forum for us to learn some more about what's happening in this community. My job is program director at the Relief Nursery Incorporated in Eugene, where the Access and Success program has existed for the last 12 years. Heather Murphy touched on it. The program began in 1992 under a federal grant that lasted for 2.5 years. It was highly successful. Similar numbers for success that Heather stated, it hovers right around 94% of the parents of the relief nursery who participate in two or more of the core services manage to stay clean and sober for a year or more, which is a phenomenal number. I'm very proud to be associated with that association. The board of directors there at the Relief Nursery decided that they could not do their business of preventing and ameliorating the effects of child abuse and neglect without the Access and Success program because of the dire effects that it has on families. So they decided that they would fund it by donations, which they did until October of last year when we received another federal grant, this time from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration. And that grant is for 4 years, and it's specifically peer-to-peer recovery support services. What we are doing with that money is increasing the services in Eugene and replicating the Access and Success program in Cottage Grove, Salem, and a mentorship program for pre- and post-release for women in the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. I've heard many good things tonight, and I just I support most of what I heard. I believe it to be the truth. We need long-term treatment. We do need prison beds. We need many, many things that there's no money for. And I really hope to encourage you to continue to write bills, to raise some taxes in our state. I see the current crisis that covers the entire budget, governor's budget of the state of Oregon, as being a direct result of the measures failing. And I believe that it's going to get a lot worse before it gets better. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the families in our program. There's one common thread. Actually, there's two common threads that run throughout the program. The parents love their children. And I'm sorry, I don't remember his name, the health teacher. It's not a choice. They don't choose meth over their children. It's once addicted, it doesn't matter about anything. And short-term treatment, such as what we only have money for now, is not the answer. Please don't misunderstand me in that treatment is a vital part of saving these families and getting people into recovery. However, the meth problem and the meth addiction is such an insidious addiction that 3 weeks in residential treatment or 3 months in outpatient treatment is not going to touch it. Jean Phelps, our executive director, did something incredibly amazing, and Senator, I commend you because you did the same thing tonight with the young women. You asked the people with the problem what would help, and that's what Jean Phelps did. Back in 1991, after we had two deaths directly related to methamphetamines. One person died of an overdose, and another person died in a drug deal gone bad. She was murdered. And at that point, Jean didn't know what to do. She's not an addict. She's not a drug counselor. But she knew where to find the answers. She asked the parents who were addicted, and most of them newly in recovery, what would help them stay in recovery. And then they designed this program around it. And I'm going to finish up here with just a little personal information. I myself am a recovery and methamphetamine addict. Two of my four children are recovering methamphetamine addicts. I have a daughter that, I don't know, she's right at the age that I was when I started using. And so I don't have an opinion yet about whether she's an addict or not. She does have two parents who are addicts, and it is a hereditary disease. So chances are she probably is. I also have a 16-year-old stepson who has had four parents, two birth parents and two step parents in recovery. And he has the same genes. And he is a healthy, active young man who is very well educated firsthand about the effects of not only meth but other drugs as well. And I don't believe he's going to ever pick up a drug. And I don't believe that if my children keep going the way they are going right now in recovery, I don't believe that my grandchildren, my five grandchildren that I have will pick up a drug and the chain won't be broken. So I really encourage you to take an interest in and fund non-traditional treatment for meth addicts. Our services are very inexpensive and very successful. And I wanted to tell you, I have 18 years in recovery, and it's possible. So don't give up. Thank you for listening to me.
Thank you.
First, I'd too like to say thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak. And let me say that I want to validate how frustrated you all are with the methamphetamine problem. And in the same breath, I want to tell you that I, too, am a recovering meth addict. And I work in the Accessing Success program. I'm one of the staff members of the Relief Nursery. All of the staff in this program are recovering and work with the parents. And what's really wonderful about the nursery is that we not only work with the children, but we're able to work with the parents as well. So they're getting all of those services at the same place. And my experience has been, you know, I lived on the streets for 15 years. I used meth intravenously. I gave birth to 2 out of 3 children in my addiction. Prison was helpful for me. I went there first, and then I was able to go to treatment, and then I had a transitional housing program where I was able to go after that. And when I went into prison, all I wanted to do was parent my children. That was my main goal for getting clean, was to parent my children. And when I was in my disease and I was out there, I didn't realize how bad it was. You know, the people around you can see how bad off you are. But when you're in it, you have a really great denial system that keeps you from allowing that and the fact that you don't feel. And so when I went into prison, that was my goal. Through treatment and other services, the transitional housing program, I was able to get a job. I was able to starting counseling and parenting classes, as well as my children having services of that kind. It was really, really helpful that the services were there for me to change my life. And I've been employed with the nursery for the last 5 years, and I attend the U of O, and I'm a certified alcohol and drug counselor. And my children are 15, 16, and 20, and none of them have picked up a drug either. So these kind of programs really do make a difference, and people really can recover. If you hear anything that I'm saying today at all, is recovery is possible. That's all I have.
I would like to add something about our population at the Relief Nursery. Of all the parents that participate in the Accessing Success program, 100% of them have used meth. That's a phenomenal number. It shocked us. My mouth literally dropped open. And about the staff of the Accessing Success program, all of us are in recovery, and most of us from meth addiction. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's one of the keys, is the peer-to-peer.
Right. Thank you. Let me ask if there's any questions. I do have one question, and that's, I guess, maybe the Carla, because you've shared with us at one point you were incarcerated. Mm-hmm. Do you have contact now with the state prison system as to knowing what programs are there, or what might not be there when you were there, and could you give us any feedback as to what we might be needing to focus on when it looks at the Department of Corrections budget where it comes to these type of programs?
Actually, I do have a connection with that. Through this grant, we're going to be doing a mentor program within the prison. And there was very limited services when I went through prison. They had cognitive behavioral therapy or cognitive... And that was the only service they provided. They didn't have treatment. And something I've noticed that Coffee Creek has is they have the ATP program as well as a treatment program. But again, their budget is getting less and less, and so they're talking that they might have to cut the treatment program, which would be detrimental, I believe, okay, if that were to happen.
Thank you. Any questions at this point? Thank you very much for coming up and testifying.
Thank you.
Go ahead and call up a panel of four. I know that these individuals are needing to get back probably towards Salem, and so I'm going to go ahead and take them at this time. Marsha Keith, if I could have you please come up. Cheryl Pellegrini, Brad Swank, as well as Pamela Levitt. You want to go in? I'm not sure if we want to go first come, first serve, because I'm not sure who was here first.
Thank you very much, Senator, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice, and I work in the Department's Financial Fraud Consumer Protection Section. Attorney General Myers wanted me to convey my thanks to each and every one of you for holding this committee and for your interest in both of these issues. He regrets that he couldn't be here tonight. I would at this point provide to you a memorandum he prepared this afternoon.
What? Cheryl, why don't you just give him to us, and that way you can go ahead and testify. Thank you.
And the memorandum that I've just handed to you concerns Senate Bill 912. The Attorney General supports that particular bill, and he wanted you to know that last month he met with other attorneys general from the western states, and they passed a resolution which unanimously supported precursor control as the most important step in the western states in taking the first step or a significant step in the fight against methamphetamine. Briefly, I'd like to turn to the collection of identity theft bills, which, Senator Przanski, you introduced, and they are Senate Bill 626, 627, 628, 629, 630, and 744. The Department at this point is taking a neutral stance on these bills, not because we don't support the principles embedded in the bills, but because in at least our initial review, it appears that they may benefit by further refinement. And to that end, the Department of Justice would offer its services should the committee like to engage us to assist in that process. As Assistant U.S. Attorney Sean Hoare observed, in 2003, Oregon ranked, I believe he said, seventh among states on a per capita basis for identity theft. In 2004, we ranked ninth. That doesn't mean we're getting better. It means that there are simply more incidences being reported across the country. I think if you look at the actual figures, there is an increase in the number of instances of identity theft, identity thefts in Oregon. In the same report, I would note that the Portland metro area ranked 12th among major metropolitan areas for fraud-related complaints, and 15th for identity theft-related complaints. Some of the top identity theft victim locations in Oregon were Salem with 169 victims and Eugene with 158 victims. I'd like to go through very quickly just each of these bills to give you an idea of what they intend to do. And I think that probably some of the other panel members can comment on them as well. Senate Bill 626 is particularly timely because there have been reports about security breaches now within private databases maintained by ChoicePoint, LexisNexis, and a shoe store called DSW. And I also have written testimony for these bills, if I can just pass them along to you. Thank you. Senate Bill 626 is modeled on California law. I think California is the only state in the United States that currently has such a law. And because of that, the 30,000 Californians who were victims of the security breach in Choice Point received notice of the breach. It wasn't until state attorney generals contacted Choice Point and demanded that it provide equal notice to their citizens that the other 120,000 citizens of various states received notice that their information had been acquired. We just point out that the lack of a definition in Senate Bill 626 for the term person may have some unintended consequences, and we just highlight that, and it's something that we'd be willing to work with the committee on.
And Cheryl, what I will tell you is that we are, in fact, taking, let's say, the general information now. We will be working the bills and taking these comments, and we'll ask you to assist us in doing that before we start moving legislation through.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 627. Would allow an individual, in essence, to designate the entities that could have access to the individual's credit report and to effectively freeze that credit report, which would prevent other entities from being able to obtain it for the purpose of extending credit. I don't know if there are any states that have such a law in place at this point. I know it is being proposed as a model law in several states. I'm sorry, currently California, Louisiana, Texas, and Vermont have legislation similar to this. And what it would do essentially is it would extend some of the existing provisions of the FACT Act, the Fair and Accurate Transactions Act. It's a federal law that went into effect in December of 2003. It would extend some of those protections to all citizens, whereas the federal law applies only to citizens who have been victims of identity theft and who have filed an identity theft report. Senate Bill 628 would it also extend the ability of citizens to obtain credit reports over the one free credit report provided by federal law for a fee. And I believe that there's two different fees involved there. Senate Bill 629 would limit the purposes for which an individual's Social Security number could be used. And essentially, it targets businesses that still use Social Security numbers as customer identification account or access numbers. Senate Bill 630 would require proper disposal of personal information, and this bill would guard against the sort of disposal that you heard about from, again, Assistant U.S. Attorney Sean Hoare, and it would require businesses that collect personal information from individuals to take certain steps to make sure that it's disposed of in a way that it cannot be recovered by thieves. Finally, Senate Bill 744 would establish a process by which a victim of identity theft could obtain a declaration from an Oregon court and then would be able to present that declaration to law enforcement or employers in order to establish that they, in fact, have been the victim of identity theft to avoid any further adverse action. So, in essence, that's what each of those bills do.
Great. Thank you. Brad.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm special counsel for government relations for the Oregon Judicial Department. I'm here representing a branch of government that collects an incredible amount of information, much of it personal information, going back not just into the 1900s, but in some instances into the 1800s. Much of what we collect is information that is required by statute or by law in order to perform an important function of government. As you approach the issue of identity theft, court documents, many of which are public record, have in fact been sources of gathering information for identity theft. But I want to make you aware of the fact that we have taken some steps in the past few years to stop some of those issues. We no longer use We no longer make Social Security numbers available as part of our database. In the last year, the Chief Justice established a procedure by which people, when they're submitting documents to a court that have personal financial information that can be used to steal an identity, can be separated from the rest of the document so it can be kept confidential from public inspection. And we currently have a proposal out for people to have a procedure to put substitute papers in what we call legacy documents that redacts information so that information that is of a personal and financial information would not be available for public inspection. But as you approach the issue of identity theft, realize that there are public documents that for years have been mandated to have certain information that is there now, going through the literally millions of documents that are there is a huge issue. And so it's important when you address some of this information to know whether or not you're addressing legacy documents and whether or not you're addressing public bodies. Some of these bills, for instance, 626 and 630, that you're talking about are not clear about whether or not they address public bodies in addition to addressing private bodies. Some of them are very clear and clearly exclude public. So to the extent that you're doing this, it's important to make the distinction. If you want to include bodies, we would like to. We're more than willing to help you work through the process that would be necessary to determine what you want to do with the information in the future. Some of them, like Senate Bill, one of them, Senate Bill 744, establishes a process for achieving an end that involves a method that's fairly resource intensive. We believe that there's probably a less resource intensive way of accomplishing the same end. As with Ms. Pellegrini, as you work through these bills, we would like to express, and I've already spoken to the chair, and he knows our concerns about these, our willingness to come to the table and help you work through these in a way that achieves the ends that you want and helps protect the citizens of this state. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Marcia Keith, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. And if you're like everyone else, when I explain who I'm representing in connection with the topic of precursor to methamphetamine, you probably are looking at me in puzzlement. Although the veterinarians have not been as affected as some of the people who testified in front of you tonight in such horrific and heartrending terms, it is nevertheless true that veterinarians are a result of the ripple effect or the domino effect of that person who goes in to buy Sudafed or Ephedrine and creates this larger and larger and larger problem that has impact on other societal entities. Veterinarians were affected by the first big methamphetamine precursor bill because they in fact do prescribe and dispense ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, phenyl, whatever that is, phenylphenylamine, something like that, PPA, okay? I'll pay you a quarter if I can just say PPA. I know, I'm looking at him, right? I'm looking at him out of the corner of my eye. He's not helping me at all, you can see. No. The two bills that I'm specifically concerned about tonight are Senate Bills 313 and Senate Bill 912, and I have presented you with written testimony. I won't go into the amendments that we would like to have, but just please know that they are critical to the Veterinary Medical Association. I don't believe anyone has any objection to them. We've worked with Rob Bobet, who has been one of the chief drafters of the methamphetamine precursor bill on these issues. So I just thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. And you probably don't need to move it too closely from what I understand.
Members of the committee, I'm Pam, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Pam Lovett with the Credit Union Association of Oregon. I will be very brief. Before I start, I wanted to commend the students in the audience because it was my senior year in high school. I attended a city council meeting And I was addicted to government and politics ever since and have made my living in it. So I want to commend the students for being here today, sitting through all of this. You probably can realize why credit unions in Oregon care about identity theft, but why meth? If you look at the second paragraph of my testimony, according to the Portland FBI, 90% of robberies in the area are related to meth habits. And obviously, bank and credit union robberies are an issue. We participate in the Financial Institution Security Task Force made up of law enforcement and financial institutions, and the number one issue is meth and identity theft. Several of these bills, starting with Senate Bill 626 and going to Senate Bill 744, relate to some form of privacy, sharing of information, social security numbers. Credit unions and other financial institutions comply with some very serious federal laws, Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act. You heard about the FACT Act. I heard today from one of my members related to U.S. Patriot Act, how we need Social Security numbers for that. So as you move forward with these bills, we'd like to work with you. I did submit testimony with some concerns from credit unions about some of these bills and how they're written. But we do believe that, again, there's some unintended consequences. We don't want to limit consumers' access to get lending and credit, and we believe limiting some of the credit reporting would limit individuals and consumers' access to that. So if these bills do move forward, we will be providing some additional comments.
Thank you. Any questions for the panelists? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next individual I'd like to call up is Rick, I'm not sure which one it is, Dotson, Sally Ledoux, and Pat Patterson. Thank you for each of you being here and being patient.
My name is Rick Dotson. I work for Lane County. And with what I do, I have quite a bit of contact with people that are involved with meth and other drugs. And my thoughts are very simple ones, that one of the biggest problems right now, from what I understand from talking to them, is the breakdown in the family fundamentals, the morals and values. The families are breaking up, and usually the kids get shipped to one person while the other one is left completely out and their life is destroyed through divorce. My thought would be, in Lane County, we have a problem in the court system. 5 years ago, I went through a divorce here in Lane County, and the reason I went through a divorce was because I attempted to keep my kids away from a sex abuser, a molester. In me doing so, my wife ended up asking for a divorce. I went to the circuit court here in Lane County, and my life was pretty much destroyed. It seems that there's always one side that they want to take everything from and give to the other side, including the children. And then the children are left to fend through that one person trying to decide what's right and wrong. And I've had to fight to keep my morals and values within my children, because financially they pretty much destroyed me and several, and that's what they're doing to several of these people that are going to prisons. And in doing so, Mr. Parker was here. I have discussed this with every person that's possible, commissioners, council people, and nobody seems to want to step up and deal with the problem. In my meeting with Mr. Harkerow, his solution was that with his position as district attorney, I had a friend with me there that can verify his exact words for anything I did in the court system to try to expose what the unethical judges were doing, he would use his position as district attorney to block anything and everything I did. And after that statement, he had us escorted out of the building with two of his detectives. This is what a father goes through, or sometimes a mother, but the majority of the time it's a father, in trying to stay with his children, and that's why so many fathers are being taken out of the picture. You have to fight to stay in your kid's life. The woman wants to take the children and the money and move on, and you're left with basically nothing. A lot of fathers are having to move back in with their parents. A lot of fathers are having to move into garages because they're completely removed from the family. Then these kids grow up not knowing right from wrong. They're left to fend for themselves. They go to daycare. They go to after-school activities where they run into other kids, some with not so good morals and values. In trying to deal with this problem, and to keep it brief and ending, I've been going through this for 5 years, and I would do it all again to protect my kids. After 4 years of pushing the issue, the guy that I was trying to keep them away from ended up moving out of state because I finally put enough pressure on him, not through law enforcement, not through the district attorney's office. I had to force the issue to keep a child molester in this county away from my children. The last hearing I went, right now I'm paying over $250 more than I'm supposed to be in child support. You would think that you've got guidelines, you plug in the numbers and everything comes out correct. That's not the way it is in Lane County. Right now I'm paying over $250 more than I'm supposed to. And I tried to address with the district attorney Harper Road with the person in charge of the child support. Her name is Carol Chadwick. And I asked for a hearing to get it adjusted again after 5 years. And I'll give you a brief thing that happened with this court hearing. The first thing the judge did, I had subpoenaed people from the district attorney's office to address why they were overcharging.
Mr. Dotson.
Two people from the district attorney's office, and they...
Mr. Dotson, I'm going to ask you a question. I'm listening to the testimony, and I'm not seeing how it is relating back to the meth issue as well as the identity theft. It seems like this may be some personal issues that you have within the legal system. And if it is, I just want to make sure that you understand, as much as we might want to try to help you, we are not in a capacity as state legislators to be able to intervene at something that's at that level.
Okay. I do understand what you're saying, and that's what I get from everybody that I turn to. Mr. Harker wrote, sat up here and painted a very pretty picture of himself and kids. I'm trying to bring out the truth. At the last hearing that I had to get that child support adjusted, the first thing the judge did was dismiss all my witnesses, told them to leave the courtroom. After that, I tried to submit legal documentation to show that I was being overcharged by $250. The judge said he didn't want to see it. After that, I asked him to swear my ex-wife in so I could address this. What had happened was perjury, and you've got attorneys that are encouraged to submit fraudulent affidavits so that they can come to the judgment they want. And I wanted to submit this to the judge. He didn't want to see it. I asked him to swear in the other party so that I could ask her questions to show the fraud that was going on and what was going on. He said it wasn't hearing for witnesses. So in the end, he said it again for $250 more than our guidelines here in Oregon. And I have nowhere to go to get that fixed.
Mr. Dotson, all I'm going to suggest to you, it seems to me that you really need to speak to legal an attorney that can represent you in these rights. This panel is not versed in this area. And as I said, our venue does not interfere into the court proceedings. It's what I'm hearing is issues that you need to take up through the court system and through the redress, that if you're not getting that through the appellate process.
I understand that, sir. All I wanted to do was tell my side of this. We want to know why kids are getting into drugs. When fathers are removed from the families and fathers cannot present their morals and values, you have a very big problem.
Mr. Dotson, thank you for your time. Ms. Ledoux.
Yes. Thank you all for being here. My name is Sally Ledoux. I work with Women's Space. I'm the rural advocate here in Cottage Grove. I've been working with domestic violence and sexual abuse intervention since 1981 in Texas, New Mexico, California, and now Oregon. I'm very happy to be here. I have never seen such a problem, drug problem, with meth per capita as I have working here, except for the inner city of the San Francisco Tenderloin. My numbers My percentages are very high. The DA and the representative of the ADA has told you that domestic violence is directly related to meth use and child abuse. I have women that are coming to me that need treatment, and in order to effect a good intervention with domestic violence, I also need to couple that with treatment, so I am asking you all to help us with some treatment for intervention.
Okay, thank you very much. Pat?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Pat Patterson. I'm a city councilor for the city of Cottage Grove. I have been involved in youth work for better than 50 years. I have also been a counselor in a camp, and I have had to deal with kids that get into trouble. My wife and I spent time working in the kindergarten here at Harrison School for a number of years, and we dealt with the kindergarten kids. And there were a number of them that came in from child abuse families and also those that were drugged. This was before we got the relief nursery, and this was in the kindergarten area and first grade area. The comment was made tonight, when do you start drug information? I think under the right circumstances and with the right qualified people to do that, it's never too early to start it within the public school system. I think there's a place for it. And I think you can start at the kindergarten. We used to have the DARE program in here that was fairly successful. But again, that costs money. But it also gave a relationship between the police and the youth, so there wasn't an adversarial attitude. Some of the children that Colleen and I dealt with were abused. Their families were drug addicts. Colleen drove school bus for the South Lane School District for 20 years, and her job was a factor of working with these type of children that went up to the into the school system in Eugene, because we didn't have the ability to do it from the standpoint we didn't have the money, and there was a better training areas up in there. Spina bifida, some of the drug actions, some of the child abuse and other ones. So I've had exposure to that type of program. I've also had the very bad fortune of having been in a youth camp a couple of times where I have been informed about child abuse and also where there were narcotics. And I've gotten a pretty bad reputation that when I come to town, you better be clean or you're in deep trouble. Now, having said that, it's my observation since I've been in the state of Oregon since 1954. When I came to here, I worked in Tillamook, Oregon. And a fellow by the name of Ron Smith, who ended up as number two, I think, in the state forestry, brought me up to Tillamook. At that time, there was a youth type of program where you took 15, 16-year-old young gentlemen at that time, and you stuck them out on state land to clean up parks, trail work, and these types of opportunity. There's a lot of them that graduated from that organization and worked in the state forestry because of the factor that the state of Oregon was able to do that. It wasn't until the law was changed so that you couldn't put these young men. Now we can usually say young ladies when properly supervised, into an environment where you pull them out of a very unhappy situation, even if it's only for the summer. I think in a lot of cases these kids don't have self-worth. And self-worth is the ability to go out and find an employment opportunity somewhere where they can go out and work in a pea field or anywhere where they can actually gain income of themselves. I think we've destroyed the work ethic of our younger generation because it's become so easy to get involved with narcotics, in this type of programs, and it doesn't have it because that's the only place they can make any financial gain to pay for their school books, to stay play for their clothing in some cases, and also when they get into high school, it's nice to be able to take the hot rod out and the girls. So there's a lot of other things. But I think we have to start establishing something that gives this youth credibility. These young ladies and gentlemen, Sarah over here, is the beginning of trying to get some people to understand what city government is and what it is and where it starts from. And Richard's done a very fine job of putting that together. But what I bring to you is we have to go beyond the problem. We have to find an alternative that will give these young ladies and gentlemen self-worth and where they can go out and be out of an exposed area for no matter, and not incarcerate them, but go out and give them something that's gainful and they feel that they can accomplish some self-worth. I think if you start from that point, it's not going to be done overnight, and you're not going to win them all. But if you can save two or three kids along the side and get their head squared away, it'll be worth it. But you've got to start somewhere, and you've got to give these kids a feeling of self-worth where they can go out and find some opportunity of the agricultural area or something else and get a lot of these antiquated, touchy-touchy, feely-good laws, because we can't do that because we might disturb the young man's head or the young lady's head. Oh, they're so young, they shouldn't have to be forced into that. It doesn't hurt for them to learn what it is to work for a living. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you. That's everyone that I have signed up on the wanting to witness registry, with the exception of two individuals who did not answer when I called earlier, Amanda Kramer and Diana Kramer, if they're here. And if not, is there anyone that has not signed up that wanted to address the committee? If not, counsel, is there anything else we need to do? I want to thank everyone for coming out tonight and letting us be part of Cottage Grove, and thank you, and the meeting is closed.